really amazed by this guy. But it is true, that's a fiction. But you'll be surprised, the story I'm going to tell you actually, it can come true if you got the right thing in your body there. So, yeah, everyone knows Hank is a hero, right? So the question is, how can you get this enormous big mass of the muscles? Actually, scientists have seen very similar phenotype. If you have one gene mutated or if you have one activity, shows at a very high level, even in human bodies, you can actually create a hunk. So look at this boo. It's called Belgian boo. So one striking phenotype of this boo is their muscle mass is double-sized compared to a normal boo. So what happened to this boo? Actually, they have this mutation in one of the gene called myostatin. So myostatin is a TGF-beta family members. So myo gene binds to its activating a type 2 receptor. So it's a class of receptor tyrosine kinase, so which is a topic we are going to cover today. So today, we are going to talk about what's receptor tyrosine kinase, how it's being activated, so what kind of downstream effector they will activate, and also the, what's the functional mechanism of this actor. So what happened to the myostatin is, myostatin normally is an inhibitor in our body to block the muscle fusion, and especially to inhibit the proliferation of the myoblast and fuse to form these kind of skeletal muscles. So people have tried to mutate, or sometimes you have some natural occurred mutation in human bodies. In these individuals, they can have up to twice the usual amount of the muscle mass in their body, and amazingly, without any side effect. So their intelligence are normal. They look perfectly fine. They grow normally. Nothing special there. So they're just super strong. So you can imagine, people look at this kind of mutation in kind of top performers in the sports, right? So people find actually one class of the top racing dog called Whippet. They have this mutation there. So in these dogs, they have one allele, have this kind of two base pair deletion there. Even one allele mutation is enough to make this kind of dog super strong. So you can imagine scientists are trying to develop this inhibitor in the test tube. In order, maybe we can treat the muscular dystrophy. So it's kind of weakening of your muscle along your lifespan. It's affecting many patients. Actually, just this year, a company developed a drug called MYO-029. They even just did one round of clinical trial, but for some reason they refused to develop this drug further because it seems like they have very strong interest from some athletes. So they stopped that. So, well, they adapt the name, the myostatin, because of this kind of incredible hunk. They use this name. Its original name is a growth differentiation factor 8. Okay, so this is a receptor tyrosine kinase. So last time, we covered the other type of the membrane receptor on the membrane is called G-protein coupled receptor, right? So, oh yeah, one question is there, is this kind of really, G-protein is a part of the GPCR? It's not. It interacts with GPCR. I know it's confusing just looking at this kind of connection there, but well, I know anyway, I don't really know why they draw this way, but it's just protein-protein interaction there. But The one thing for this kind of G-protein coupled receptor is they show their own unique way to be activated. So who can tell me how GPCR is activated? Anyone? Okay. I can do it. It binds to ligand. But the ligand binding, the key of this ligand binding is the ligand will change the position. They have this kind of seven transmembrane alpha helix. The ligand binding will change the conformation of the several alpha helix here. So this conformation change will induce the interaction with the G protein. So therefore activate the G protein. But if you look at the, we call either called enzyme coupled cell surface receptor, or we call it receptor tyrosine kinases. The problem is all these receptors have only one transmembrane domain there, which means even they bind to the ligand, it's kind of hard for this kind of receptor to twist around to introduce a conformation change there. So the question is, how this receptor being activated? So basically, they adapt a very different mechanism. I will introduce in the next slide. So first is all these, essentially all these enzyme-coupled cell surface receptors only have one transmembrane domain. They pass through membrane once. So they have this domain can expose to outside, can interact with ligand. So also have this endogenous cytosolic phase, which normally has a kinase domain. So this kinase domain will be activated if the ligand binds to the extracellular surface. So you can imagine we see so many famous players in these families, right? So we argue that such G protein family, we have something around 300 G protein in our genome, and most of them very important because 25% of this G protein has been used as drug target. But if you look at this receptor mediated kinase, you can see many growth factor, which is essential for our tissue development. EGF receptor, insulin receptor, a neuronal growth receptor, all kinds of them. But what happened to the receptor tyrosine kinase is whatever ligand binds to the receptor, they not only bind one of them, they bind two of them. So the end result of this binding is they will pull these two receptors together. So the term we can use here is called induced proximity. So you'll be amazed, so many proteins, so many enzymes, so many kinases being activated by this mechanism, close proximity. If you bring enzymes together, they will become auto-activated. So that's exactly what happened to this group of tyrosine kinases. The signal molecule will bring these two together. So their kinase domain will be activated, will phosphorylate this protein at different sites. And this will induce a just dramatic signal transduction change there. But you can also imagine because of this kind of dimerization effect, people love to use this kind of dominant negative approach to study the function of these receptors. Since you can mutate one of the kinase domain in one of the receptor, this one still binds to the other one, still can respond to the signal molecule, but they cannot auto-phosphorate each other, or they cannot phosphorate each other. So in this way, they have no kinase activity. So dominant active concept, you can argue that it's essentially derived from this early study. Again, look at these tables. So you can see many growth factor belongs to this family. So it's a very important field. Upon the activation of the kinase domain, they will phosphorylate this cytosolic tail at different tyrosine residue. Right? That's the name comes from. It's receptor tyrosine kinase. So this is the kinase domain. So they will phosphorylate tyrosine residue at different position. Strikingly, these tyrosine at different position, they can bind to different proteins to mediate different response. Still, nobody can estimate how much protein can bind even to one single RTK there. Theoretically, they have many protein can bind the different position of this phosphate tyrosine and relay signal to the downstream there. So it's not just one protein activate or one pathway there. Normally, one RTK can activate multiple pathways there. So the question is, what kind of protein combines to this tyrosine residue? It's a protein, the first identified protein combines to tyrosine residue. They all have this SH domain, the Src homology domain. So it's in red. So they have SH2 domain, SH3 domain there. So basically, you can see all different adaptive proteins, they all have this SH2 or SH3 domain. So SH2 domain is specifically designed to bind to phosphotyrosine. So they have major through three groups, PI3K, phospholipase, and GTP as activating protein. So it's all old friends. We have been covering these proteins in the last several lectures. So what kind of structure of the SH2 domain looks like? This is a structure of a SH2 domain. So you can see as a two alpha helix and several beta sheet. So it has one side, it can bind to the phosphotyrosine, and the other side will bind to the amino acid side chain. So if you look at from the different way, you will be amazed. All these SH2 domains are exactly like a plug-in molecule. So they create two hosts. One of them will bind to phosphotyrosine. The other one will bind to a critical amino acid side chain. Sometimes could be just isoleucine or leucine. So you can imagine the great benefit of this kind of plug-in system is first, when they bind, they don't change the conformation of the RTK protein. That is why one RTK can bind so many adaptive protein, right? Because upon binding, nothing happened to the other region. Other region is fine. They just bind to this region, only affected by this region. And also because this kind of whole structure, they can define the specificity of individual phosphotyrosine and the side chain there. So that's why one RTK combines to so many different adaptive proteins here. So it's very unique with high efficiency. Yes?
Can you express an SH2 domain from, say, phospholipase onto a gap and it
would bind? Yeah, people try that. That's essentially how they define the specificity of these individual ones. Yeah, that's a very good one. Okay, so if you have SH2 domain, so what's the downstream of its SH2 domain? So you can imagine this SH2 domain protein binds to tyrosine receptor. So what's its downstream? Well, this is a group of old friends, just the GTPs. So sometimes people call it monomeric GTPs. Sometimes you call it small GTPs. Sometimes people call it non-receptor GTPs. Well, the only way you can just separate this GTPs from this kind of GPCR, right? It's kind of gigantic membrane protein, have this kind of seven transmembrane domain there. So these GTPs, normally the protein size is quite small, so they don't have this kind of transmembrane sections. At least they don't have seven transmembrane sections. But if you look at this family, So many of them, like RAM protein, involve this kind of transportation. RAS protein, it's involved this kind of signal transduction pathway. So we also have the RAP protein. We have covered just to regulate this kind of vesicle trafficking. ARF is also required for this kind of cold protein formation and vesicle trafficking. So up to date, they have 8 different families of this kind of GDPS protein in the literature. So they regulate the cellular pathway in many aspects. Well, let's just go through the historically how they identified the first RAS protein and why is that important. Why this kind of RAS protein is so catch so much attention at the very beginning? Because the RAS protein and a lot of similar protein, they are the first group oncogene. Or you can imagine in the 60s, that's a big, big thing. Oncogene means if you amplify or express this protein, they cause cancer. So do you know what's the first oncogene being identified? Salk. By who? Any name? Okay, that's good. Salk. In 1970, well, many scientists working on Salk, that's for sure. But first calculation or definition of Salk actually is done by Steve Martin in our department. RAS is the one protein. Actually, it's a big surprise when the people trying to look at this kind of oncogene in 1960s, because all these whatever tumors, they are induced by virus. That's a surprise, right? So basically, you can see that if you inject the mice with the chicken virus, always a virus from the rat leukemia, these virus cause tumor. But you can imagine at that time, people saying, okay, that's just artifacts, it's bullshit, right? So who cares about a tumor caused by the chicken virus, right? Something must be wrong there. It's not really virus. It must be endogenous. Somehow something is wrong with your body and you got cancer. People never get infected by chicken that got cancer there. But eventually, people realize that all these kind of chicken oncogenes, our human body have exactly the same homology to these proteins. Like Salk protein, normally we call viral version, we call V-Salk. But if you look at your human body, we have a Salk protein too. We have a RAS protein too. So that's why in 1976, two scientists defined this kind of oncogene actually. It's just our human body have all its oncogene. When they become defective, it leads to cancer. So that's why they win the Nobel Prize for this one. Okay, but let's figure out how the RAS signaling pathway has been discovered. This is a really classical genetic experiment. It's been cited so many times, and it's been used in different systems by different scientists, mapping out many different genetic pathways. So it's a beautiful system. Okay, I will give some background first. So people, when they look at this kind of signaling pathway, they look at the Drosophila. So basically, they have a phenotype. Just they look at the Ommatidia, which is the eyes of the Drosophila. This is the eyes of Drosophila. You can see it's so many different small units. So they have 800 Ommatidia units. So every single one Ommatidia have 8 photoreceptors and 12 accessory proteins. So among these 8 photoreceptor cells, one of them actually can specifically detect UV light. So people use this one to screen for the mutant. So this 8 cell developed through a very interesting pattern. So R8 is first developed, then R2 and R5, then they will be responsible for adjacent cell development, and R7 cell will be the last one to develop. But R7 cell is so easy to be distinguished because without R7, they can't sense the UV light. So what happened to this? So people just look at specific mutant, cannot sense the UV light. So soon, they discover this gene responsible for this R7 development. So there are two genes responsible for this R7 development. One in R8 cell, that makes sense, right? So R8 cell somehow is responsible. This protein called BOS. The other one actually is in R7 cells, is precursor of R7 cells. So this one is called 7, well, which means without it, the R7 cannot be developed. So this BOS is a ligand protein. Oops, sorry. And this 7 is a receptor tyrosine kinase. Then people figure, okay, we know this receptor ligand. But at that time, it's a critical question. What's the downstream of this protein, right? How can you tell what's the downstream of this protein? How can you define them? Okay, if you knock out this R7 protein in Drosophila, animal is lethal, which means you can't do anything. So they create a method to do this one. They create a method in terms of they mutate one copy of 7. So their hypothesis is, okay, if you have one copy mutated, the whole pathway is kind of crippled, right? So if you have mutation in the downstream pathway, it's a possibility you create this kind of blind phenotype again. Okay, this is a 3 mutant they identified. It's a RAS protein, an SOS protein, and DRK protein. Essentially, these 3 protein delineate this pathway. So what happened is, okay, if you have this 7 protein being activated, so the adapter protein called DRK, it has this kind of SH2 domain, will bind to this kind of phosphotyrosine and allow its SH3 domain to interact with the RAS GEF there and activate the GEF. So we know that it's for the nucleotide exchange. So they will activate the RAS protein, exchange the GTP and replace with GTP there. And this activated RAS protein will activate downstream signals, which I will cover in the next slide. But anyway, so this one provide a very elegant genetic analysis to prove that this pathway is not only required and sufficient for this development. So let's go through how they did this kind of genetic analysis. So basically, if you have functional 7 and the RAS protein, you will have R7 cell, which means you can detect UV light. Well, if you mutate 7, there's no R7. If you mutate RAS, there's no R7. You can imagine that, right? So it's all required. But if you mutate one copy of 7 and one copy of RAS, actually the synergistic effect is enough to kill these R7 cells. So it's no R7 cells. And furthermore, if you have two copies of the R7 mutated, but you have a super, super active RAS mutant, so they can still relay the signal to the downstream. In this case, well, you can still develop R7 cells. So this defines the upstream and downstream signaling a relationship and also define the essential or requirements of this pathway. So what's the downstream of the RAS? So if you have this kind of RDK, SH2 domain, GEF, and RAS activation, what's next? So all these events now happening on the membrane. So they must relay this signal from the membrane, go into the cytosol, and go to the nuclear. In this case, they will regulate gene expression. So how does that achieve? Basically, the RAS protein, they will activate a group of kinase. So first, the RAP protein, they will activate the MAP, kinase. Well, yeah, it's how they name it. I guess they name this MAP kinase first, then they have this kinase, okay. They have another name called RAP protein, and this, you can imagine, this is a kinase signaling cascade, so they can phosphorylate just the downstream kinase, and downstream kinase can phosphorylate downstream kinase. But at the end, a lot of effector protein or substrate will be phosphorylated in this way. So we'll activate the whole pathway. So you can imagine this pathway, it's a central player in this kind of oncogene study, cell growth analysis, and many different pathways. So this is trying to illustrate just one thing. Sometimes, actually most of the case, they have another group of protein called scaffold protein. So scaffold protein, again, is trying to diversify the signal, right? So you only have a certain amount of RTK, you only have certain amount downstream MAP kinase molecules. So how can you amplify the signal and without loss the specificity? So the cell managed to achieve that by generating a lot of scaffold protein. In this case, the scaffold protein, they can only respond to certain stimuli, just a conformation change of certain stimuli, and they will allow these downstream, commonly shared downstream protein kinase bind to a specific defined protein site. So you can imagine one scaffold protein can enrich certain sets of downstream proteins. And another scaffold protein will enrich another set of the downstream proteins. In this case, you can imagine the scaffold protein, although they receive signal from upstream and relay their signal to the, probably the same downstream protein, but they can have very distinctive pathway there. So they won't interfere with each other there. The scaffolding actually is one of the ways to define the specificity there. Another very critical effector of this tyrosine receptor is PI3K. So we mentioned PI3K many times, and we will go through it here again. So what happens is we have different phosphoinositol on the plasma membrane. So you have this kind of phosphoinositol without phosphorylation, but pay attention, okay, they always have a phosphor group at one position. So they can have this kind of originally prototype at phosphorylation group at phosphate group at 4 position or 4-5 position. And PI3K will phosphorylate all these phosphoinositol at 3 positions. So why this one is so important? Well, I guess just it's designed in this way. The PI3K C3 plays such a critical PI3K plays such a critical function in the cell growth. That's why this pathway stands out to be a very important pathway. Both G protein coupled receptor and receptor tyrosine kinase can regulate PI3K. Essentially, you can see that by different class. But what happened to this PI3K signaling pathway is you have this kind of activated receptor tyrosine kinase. So they can bind to this kind of PI3K kinase, and they will activate, they will phosphorylate the PI3-4-5P. So PI-4-5P is the most abundant phosphoinositol on the plasma membrane. And also you can imagine PI-3-4-5P is the most effective signals on the plasma membrane. What happened to these PIP pipes, pipe 3, is there's a group of protein can specifically bind to the pipe 3. So normally these group of protein have this domain called pH domain, the plexidrin homology domain. So they have another domain can also bind to the pipe 3 as well. All these pipe 3 binding protein, they are, most of them are protein kinase, like PDK1 and AKT. These protein kinase can bind to this pipe 3 directly, so they can activate downstream kinase like mTOR and allow many different signaling pathways, such as mTOR. For example, mTOR can regulate the ribosome activity. So we'll increase or decrease our protein synthesis. And mTOR can also regulate degradation pathway. So you can imagine mTOR can, in one way, regulate protein synthesis, in another way, regulate the protein degradation. So the synergistic effect by different signals, so you will have the growth, all kind of retrieval of these different tissues. So basically, this is just one illustration of how it works. So basically, you have active AKT, they can phosphorylate a pro-death protein called BAT. So BAT normally binds to its inhibitor. So phosphorylation of the BAT will dissociate from its inhibitor. So therefore, they can actually it's, yeah, this is the reverse way, sorry. AKT actually plays a survival role here. So normally you have a BAT binds to its inhibitor. This is a very bad example, I have to say that. I've been working on apoptosis for 5 years. So this is, it's not really a well-presented case here. So it's a much better case than these ones. This study only being followed by very few labs. Anyway, so it's just the phosphorylation events. Actually, we will have a lecture talking about apoptosis later, so we can give more background there. So I guess sometimes, you know, the textbook is written by certain guys, so they only emphasize on certain parts. That's why they're only talking about RAS, not talking about SARC at all. You can see probably Steve Martin is not writing that, that's why. Okay. Yeah, this is a summarize of what kind of pathway are regulated by these two critical enzymes. So one is a G-protein coupled receptor. The other one is RTK. So the critical downstream player is the G-protein coupled receptor will activate the G-protein and also indirectly activate the phospholipase. And this RTK will activate PI3K and GRB2. I have to remind you, actually, PI3K can also be regulated this one. So it's a lot of crosstalk there. But anyway, this covers essentially the most part we have gone through in the last couple of lectures. So you can see the cyclic AMP will be activated. The calcium will be also a critical downstream response. And protein kinase C and all these kind of small GTPs, all the MAP kinase, will be involved, and also the PI3K downstream events. Well, I understand your feeling when you look at these figures. It's kind of, right? It's complicated. But I have to say that if you can really memorize this chart or this table, this figure, so you can talk to most of the signaling pathway scientists. But basically, they will somehow relate it to one of these ones. So it's a good thing to memorize these things, you know. It's covered the most of the signaling transduction pathway. If you name any professor in the Berkeley campus, they have some connection somewhere. So it's good for you to know this, absolutely. Okay, let's go back to the first slide. So what's this myosin? What this myosin just can incredibly increase its muscle mass? What's this protein do? So myosin belongs to a family called transforming growth factor, TGF-beta superfamily. So myosin is just a secreted ligand, just like the TGF-beta. Right? It's a ligand. It can bind to its receptor. And what happens to this TGF-beta is they will bind to the receptor. And what happens next is when they bring close, when these two receptors are brought close, the type 2 receptor will phosphorylate type 1 and activate type 1. The type 1 receptor then will phosphorylate downstream substrate called SMAD2O3. So SMAD2O3 then will dissociate upon its phosphorylation, will dissociate from this receptor and dimerize with SMAD4 there. And this kind of dimerization will allow this kind of this protein complex go into the nuclear and function as a promoter and just activate or inhibit many genes expression. So what myostatin doing there is actually it functions in a very similar pathway. It's bind receptor, but at end result is the myostatin will block a critical factor called MALD. MALD is responsible for the muscle development. So you can imagine this inhibition allow just the muscle differentiation from stem cell to the muscle fiber. So which means originally you have certain muscle fiber derived from the stem cell, but normally you have this kind of myostatin to shut down this process. They don't allow too much muscle fiber being developed. But if you inhibit the myostatin activity, so they kind of this process become uncontrolled, you will generate more muscle fiber. So basically, you will not only have more muscle cells, also your muscle cell, each individual cell will have super activity. Well, I guess this is still an ongoing story there. Maybe in the future, you will see this drug on the market sooner or later, and you won't be surprised if you know this. Okay?